Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. We do have a little severe weather information we want to pass on to you. We knew that there was the possibility, because we have a front coming through, possibility of some severe weather this afternoon, maybe even tonight, and that's going to mean pleasant weather once we get through with this. So here it is. There is a severe thunderstorm watch that has been issued by the folks at the Storm Prediction Center in Norman, Oklahoma, and this will be in effect until 6 o'clock Central Time, and it includes a number of counties in our severe weather coverage area. Let me just run them down for you. Christian, Logan, Moultrie, Macon, McLean, Champaign, DeWitt, Piatt, Sangamon, and Shelby. We believe those are the counties that are in our area. So this is a good part of our listening area. There is a possibility for severe thunderstorms until 6 o'clock tonight. And, of course, if you stay tuned throughout the day here on AM 580, we'll bring you the latest weather information that we have. And if we get any further watches, or certainly if we get warnings, we'll get them to you right away. It looks like we're having a problem here making contact with our guest, Jed Horn, for this part of Focus 580. We'll see if we can get that show scheduled for another day. He's a reporter at the Times-Picayune. That's the newspaper in New Orleans. He shared, along with some other folks there at the paper, a Pulitzer Prize for their coverage of the after effects of Hurricane Katrina. And we'll be talking about, well, okay, maybe we do have him here. Maybe then we'll go ahead with the program that we had planned. Let me again start right over from the beginning. Of course, as you know, as you will remember, going back to August of 2005, the Gulf Coast of the United States was hit by one of the most powerful hurricanes ever to make landfall in the United States. The storm and then the flooding that followed led to the deaths of over 1,800 people, caused over $80 billion in damage. Certainly, I think that is a record for the most destructive natural disaster ever in the United States. And, of course, that it disrupted the lives of a lot of people living along the Gulf Coast in Mississippi and also in Louisiana. In this part of the program, we'll be spending a little bit of time looking back at Katrina, Hurricane Katrina, and also talk about the effort to restore and rebuild the city of New Orleans. And the guest for the program here, as soon as we get him lined up, is Jed Horn. He is right now the metro editor of the Times-Picayune newspaper. That's the newspaper in New Orleans. That's gotten a lot of credit, and I think well-deserved credit, for covering this story. And in fact, Jed Horn shared, along with some other people there at the paper, in a Pulitzer Prize for the coverage of Hurricane Katrina. He also wrote a book which came out last year, and I think a lot of people regard it as one of the best books about Katrina and the after effects. His book, Breach of Faith, Hurricane Katrina and the Near Death of a Great American City. That's the subtitle. Random House is the publisher, and I'm sure that you can continue to find the book in the bookstore or also at the library. He's also authored the book Desire Street, A True Story of Death and Deliverance in New Orleans. That book was nominated for the 2006 Edgar Award for Nonfiction Crime Writing, and he makes his home in New Orleans, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, of course, questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means no matter where you're listening, if you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, or if you might happen to be listening on the internet, you can certainly give us a call. That toll-free is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Horn, hello.
Hello there.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Sure, my pleasure. David?
Yes, that's right.
Good enough.
We certainly appreciate you giving us some of your time. I'm sure you are busy enough. Well, you know, here we are now, just a couple of weeks away from the beginning of another hurricane season. Folks there in New Orleans made it through the season after Katrina. Is now that we're approaching the next season, how do people think about that? Is there a feeling of apprehension? Do people think about what could happen on the outside chance that another big storm could come along?
Well, absolutely, and that really is a year-round kind of background sense of anxiety that we all live with. At the same time, I think some of the horror that we went through with Katrina has begun to fade, as reasonable people might expect it would, because that was an exceptional event. We have a stronger levee system now than we did, and we seem to be stepping up our evacuation planning and our emergency response planning in ways that hopefully correct the fiasco that that came down here, you know, in 2005.
Yeah. I'm interested, just today there was an editorial in the New York Times that mentioned a study that was issued last week by the Kaiser Family Foundation based on interviews that they did last fall with people living in a number of areas there around the city, Orleans, Jefferson, Plaquemines, and St. Bernard parishes, asking them about their experiences. One thing that I suppose gives one reason for optimism overall is that the survey found that 69% of the people that were involved in the survey said they were optimistic about the future, and only 11% said that they plan to leave. Do you think that's a good number?
Well, to me, the effort to quantify these things so exactly is, I mean, that's a polling science, and I think it maybe is a dubious science at this point. But I would say, roughly speaking, it reflects the reality here. A lot of people have bailed out. They were people who needed to get out for whatever the reasons were. The psychology of the place has been challenging. But I think now we are kind of down to a hardcore of resilient folk in a city that is proving to be notably resilient. Surprisingly so, really. I might have thought an awful lot more people would just give up on New Orleans, but people are drawn here by the challenge. It's been fascinating to watch a generation of younger people, indeed some from Champaign-Urbana, have been down here working with us, excited by the very mess that we're in because of the opportunities it has created for public service, for re-envisioning the urban condition, all this kind of stuff. When you have a sort of clean slate, as we did after the devastation, can be fascinating to people.
What was the population before Katrina, and how many people are there living in New Orleans now?
The population before Katrina was roughly in the neighborhood of 460,000. How many are here right now is a subject of ongoing speculation. We haven't had a full-tilt census, of course, since 2000. There was an update in 2005 that yielded that figure I just gave you. Initially, the city was empty, quite completely empty after the you know, the residual population that didn't get out in time for the storm was, in fact, removed from the city. Then it crept back up, and for a long time we sort of thought we were at about 180 to 200,000 people through the first 6 months, perhaps, after it was possible to return to the city. The recent numbers now that I put some faith in show a population which actually has spiked upwards recently, encouragingly, of about 280,000, I think, is the figure. And the conventional wisdom is that we will probably be up to the 300, 320 area fairly soon, and that may be kind of where we plateau for a period of time until the economy is stabilized and significant growth can resume.
Mm. What about the demographic makeup of the city in terms of race and ethnicity, and what the city looked like before, what the city looks like now, and maybe also what people think the city is going to be like in the future?
Well, before the storm, New Orleans was an African-American city, about two-thirds black, about maybe, I don't know, 20-25% white, significant Asian population, Vietnamese and others. These days, I think the African-American population is probably at about parity with the other groupings, maybe in the 50% range, which is a significant change and one that is of concern to people who value New Orleans culture, which is an Afrocentric culture and a very rich and vibrant one. There has been an influx, interestingly, of Latin American immigrants and storm followers, workers, construction trades have benefited from their services, and that seems likely to change the city in a permanent way as we gain this greater Latin culture in our midst. There's always been a Latin culture in New Orleans ever since the glory days of the United Fruit Company, which basically owned Central America and ran bananas up from Guatemala and Honduras to the port of New Orleans, a large population of Hondurans in particular. But the storm has brought with it a Mexican population, hardworking and quite welcome here. But it's a different group than I've been accustomed to in the past.
I suppose that there were some people who said after the storm that they felt that New Orleans would never be what it was before. That doesn't necessarily mean that it couldn't be, again, a strong, vibrant, exciting city. But how do you feel about that? And for those people who'd say that it never will be what it was, do you think that that's true?
Well, you don't go through a convulsion like Katrina and come out exactly where you were before. The fear is that we come out of Katrina, you know, more like the rest of America, when we've always prided ourselves on being a kind of an eccentric and a very different sort of city, a more exotic city, a Caribbean city, rather than a southern city. The fear is that, you know, the old ways die out or have been washed away, and we wind up with just a city of strip malls and other more conventional kinds of economic and social arrangements of the type that you would find in so many other American cities. That isn't happening. We are, I think, pulling back together the extraordinary culture that makes New Orleans fascinating to the rest of the world and a great place to live for those of us who enjoy the food, the music, and all the rest of that stuff that is part of the New Orleans mystique. And that is coming back, but it's coming back, you know, as I say, with changes. We're seeing, you know, we're seeing a Latin infusion. We're seeing, you know, we're seeing Latin nightclubs. We're seeing a loss of some of our artists. We've seen a more complete loss of kind of middle-class professionals. We've lost too many medical professionals. There's been a kind of a brain drain, people who perhaps didn't contribute all that much to the culture, but who were important economically to the city, have bailed on us. We are not happy about that. They have their own priorities and their own agendas, and they did not include standing fast with New Orleans, perhaps. That's life. That's the real world. But New Orleans is not going to be turned into a strip mall. Neither is it going to be turned into a kind of a quaint museum of its former self. And that was another concern, that we become a Disneyland, that we would become Williamsburg, sort of curators of the culture that we used to have for real and now just kind of maintain as a tourist attraction. It's too big a city for that. It's too rich. It's too vibrant. And we have a still very, very vital and lively culture that continues to grow and evolve in the way that authentic cultures do. It's a street culture. It's a culture of jazz. It's a culture of cooking. It's a culture of carnival and Mardi Gras and all that good stuff. We just finished up with Jazz Fest, which was a marvelous success, second since the storm, and bigger than ever, and hugely well attended. And these are the kinds of things that give us great hope for our future.
Let me ask you something. Forgive me, this is a negative, but I have seen some reporting on this. As a result of the increasing numbers of Latinos, people who have come into, because there's work there for the rebuilding, do folks there worry about, is there concerns about the possibility of tension, racial tension between African Americans and Latinos?
I think you certainly have that potential. But I haven't seen any real instances of it flaring up. We don't have gangs here, for example, of the type that you hear about with great concern in Los Angeles and other places with large Latin populations. And so we haven't had that particular kind of antagonism or violence. There's an economic tension, certainly. The Latino workers have been willing to come up here and live in conditions, dormitories full of men who are sending money back home to wives and children who are not with them, that are not supported and are not supportable by the middle class or the working class African Americans who were forced out of town by the storm. And there's been tension around that issue, but at the end of the day, there's work here for pretty much anybody who wants to come back and take a job if they have the physical stamina for construction. And so there's not really a valid basis for claiming that the Latins are stealing jobs from the African Americans or the whites or from anybody else.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Jed Horn. He's Metro editor of the Times-Picayune newspaper. That's the newspaper in New Orleans, a paper that you can, by the way, read online if you're interested. He was awarded a Pulitzer Prize for his part in the paper's coverage of Hurricane Katrina and is the author of a book that was published last year, Breach of Faith, Hurricane Katrina and the Near Death of a Great American City. It's published by Random House, and we're talking this morning about the rebuilding effort, rebuilding and recovery after Katrina. Questions are welcome from people who are listening. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think as people will remember, the big problem after Katrina was the flooding that was a result of the failures of the levees and the flood control system, that the city took the initial hit from the hurricane. That wasn't for New Orleans. That wasn't the big problem. It was the flooding that came afterwards. And I want to ask you particularly about how people think about the flood protection system that exists now. Particularly here, there has been some reporting recently that comes as a result of an effort by the National Geographic. They're working on a major article that will appear, I think, later in the summer. But what they did was they brought a guy, an engineer from UC Berkeley, to come and take a look at the levees. And he finds that there are a lot of problems with the rebuilt levees.
Well, there certainly are. Bob B., I think, is the guy
that
they brought in, who actually was extremely helpful to me and lent himself and his stories and his insights to my book, Breach of Faith, along with Ray Seed, who is the other part of the National Science Foundation team that came in here and has been continuing to study the levee reconstruction process all along. You've said a couple of things that I want to stress because the politics of this are very, very important because from the politics flows the economics of our recovery. Katrina, the disaster that befell New Orleans, was not an act of God. It was a man-made disaster. As you say, the hurricane passed by, and then the federal levee system collapsed. And that's why we look to and have no choice but to look to the federal government to make good on the disaster that befell the city. There were shocking inadequacies, carelessness, perhaps contractor fraud, very clearly a lax engineering standard that resulted in factors of safety surrounding the city of New Orleans, a city of, you know, nearly 500,000 people, that were actually judged adequate only for the pasturage of cattle. It is repulsive. It is an American failure, a governmental failure without equal in this country's history. And for that reason, we can sometimes get kind of uppity and kind of angry in our insistence that the federal government make good on the reconstruction of this levee system. And to some extent, they have. Progress has certainly been made. The levee system right now is not without flaws and faults, as Bob B. correctly has decided and diagnosed them. But money has been spent, huge energy has been poured into shoring up what we had to make it better than it was before the storm. The levees that collapsed, the canals that fell apart and caused water to rush into the parts of the city that were, you know, otherwise completely unthreatened by the storm, gates have been put at their mouths, and that's a huge improvement. Other parts of the levee system have been what they call armored, which means that rock and cement and various kinds of surfacing have been put on their walls, on the banks of the levee, so that they don't just wash away the first time the waters begin to lap over the tops of them. But what has not happened, and this is, you know, enough to make the richest country in the world ashamed of itself, is that we have not committed yet. We have not heard a commitment yet from Washington, or we have not seen Washington put money where its mouth is when it comes to building a state-of-the-art flood defense around the city that happens to command the mouth of the most important waterway in the continent, which is, of course, the Mississippi River system. We consider it outrageous that there has not been a wholehearted and expedited move towards giving us that flood defense. It's not rocket science. It's not a terribly difficult thing to do. It would be expensive. It would cost nearly as much as we're spending every 2 or 3 months in Iraq to build a flood defense around New Orleans that would be basically foolproof. The Dutch know how to do it. If we have forgotten, if we no longer have the can-do spirit that made this country great, there are, you know, other people, contractors, if we want to privatize the job, who know how to get this work done. We await a wholehearted signal from the White House that this must happen, that this is going forward, that we're not going to play shell games with the money, that this becomes a national priority. And it is, frankly, outrageous that it hasn't to date.
We have a couple of callers here. I promise them I'll get right to them. But just, again, let me underscore this by asking this question. Do folks in New Orleans feel that if a big storm came along this year, that the levees would hold?
I think the people west of the Industrial Canal, which sort of divides the city in half, have a renewed sense of confidence. Farther to the east, I think there are questions, very simply. And parts to the south of the city, in Plaquemine Parish, which you mentioned at the outset, the levees have not been rebuilt at all. And if there's a storm coming, it behooves anybody who's down there to get the hell out, very frankly.
Well, with apologies to these callers, let me ask one further question then. One of the criticisms that was made after Katrina was that the city had no real evacuation plan, and that there, if people who could get out had means to get out, had personal transportation, they could, but there were a lot of people who could not, and people who, even if they'd wanted to leave, could not or found it very difficult to. Is there now today an evacuation plan in place? In case everybody had to get out, is there a way to get them out?
There's a plan in place. Will it work? I'm not sure. There are a couple of things to remember about the evacuation that occurred in 2005. The first is that it was the most successful and largest evacuation in history. 1 million-plus people got out of southeast Louisiana. However, another 25,000 or 50,000 people stayed behind, some because they were helpless, some because there's a long tradition of riding out storms in place in cities like New Orleans, because you never know where it's really going to go, and you figure, you know, better to just kind of tough it out at home. That's not smart, as those people, as all of us who stayed behind, learned all too sharply during Katrina. The plan now calls for buses to get people to sort of pick up points, and from there further busing out of the floodplain, out of New Orleans. If it's going to work, this is a very fine thing. I would love to see some rehearsal, some greater attention to detail, so that people had a clearer sense of exactly how it's supposed to happen. But yes, there is an improved evacuation plan within the city. And the plans that carry people out of the city worked actually remarkably well during Katrina. It just did require that people chose to evacuate and participated in those plans.
We have callers. We'll get right to them. Just very quickly again, I'll introduce our guest, Jed Horn. He's Metro editor of the Times-Picayune newspaper based in New Orleans and author of the book Breach of Faith, Hurricane Katrina and the Near Death of a Great American City. Came out last year, published by Random House. We have a couple of callers here. Others are welcome. We'll start out with someone listening in Savoy, and this is Line 1. Hello.
Good morning. You each have brought up things very close to the two question areas that I had. And I'm very glad to hear that you've, and this happened while I was been on the phone, by the way. I'm very glad that you brought up the Dutch and the type of mental spirit that brought the American growth in the 1800s. And my question now has changed somewhat. Why aren't the local people, are the local people bringing in the Dutch experts to talk about this? Why are they waiting for the federal government? And then after that one, I have a school question.
Well, the answer is that we have indeed brought the Dutch over, and we have been to Holland, and we have looked with great interest, and I think we have learned a great deal from the Dutch example. There's an interesting historical touch to all of this, which is that the Dutch, as their system proved itself inadequate to the weather conditions that they faced in the North Sea, and as they began to drain larger and larger parts of their country, came to New Orleans back nearly 100 years ago to learn how to create the drainage pumps, wonder of the world at that time, and are still, in some cases, the largest such pumps on the planet, many of them very old, but still remarkably effective in how we do drainage and how we cleared swamps for development in this part of the world. The reason why we have no choice but to wait on the federal government for this, one, the federal government effectively owns the levee system. Beyond that, the costs are absolutely beyond the means of a city of New Orleans size and always have been. The mouth of the Mississippi River is a federal asset. It is a national trust, if you will. We have recently pried from the federal government a revenue stream from offshore oil revenues, oil royalties, oil and gas royalties, which is new to us. Other parts of the country have long since been permitted to take a percent of the federal royalty from oil and gas extraction. We finally belatedly won that right. And those monies are dedicated to coastal erosion primarily, but also ultimately levee reconstruction. They amount to only a few hundred millions of dollars a year right now. They are expected to rise substantially after a decade or so. But that's not, you know, that's the beginning of a down payment on a reinforced levee system. But we cannot do it ourselves. This is a hugely expensive proposition. And the federal government, which, you know, caused the failure, is also obligated morally as well as financially and politically to repair the damage.
Okay, well, thank you for this information. I'm glad to hear the Dutch and you have been involved, and obviously some people down there need to keep the cross-fertilization going over the ensuing decades.
Mm-hmm. We hope to. It's been a very rich collaboration so far.
I don't want to get into a debate with you about who caused what, but, you know, there have been different stories about different forms of corruption at all different levels.
Sure.
And I want to switch over to the schools. What percentage of your schools have reopened, and what is the percentage of the students compared to before now? Do you have as many students, or are there less? I assume there's less. But so what is the percentage there? And then you have a bus.
Well, the percentage of students in the school system, I think, is roughly parallel to the percentage of the population that has returned, which is somewhere in the neighborhood of 50%.
The number of schools opened?
The number of schools, you know, I wish I could give you the exact numbers there because they certainly are readily available. I don't happen to have them at the tip of my tongue, but they reflect those same population.
Now the buses.
Backs.
Who paid for the buses? I saw pictures of large number of buses just drowned. I assume those all had to be junked. And who paid for the new buses?
The buses were in part, the buses have been replaced by the usual, insofar as we needed to replace them, which of course was not all of them, given that many of them were school buses, and we don't have that school population. But much of that infrastructure is financed by the state, as well as local school taxes. One interesting thing about the school system in the post-Katrina era has been, first of all, that it was fundamentally taken over by the state. The New Orleans school system was a mess. It remains a mess, as one might expect, after a catastrophe the size of what we've been through. But it was a mess prior, too, with horrendous, it's rather like Chicago's system, maybe 15 or 20 years ago, terrible, terrible student performance, corruption, thievery, the looting, effectively, of the physical assets of that school system, a jobs program for people who might otherwise have been unemployable, rather than a system dedicated to the education of young people. Finally, in the aftermath of Katrina, the state saw an opportunity and simply took it away, for all intents and purposes, from the school board, which had been so inadequate in the management of it. And much of it has been the experiment in reorganizing it has been predicated on charter schools. A lot of the schools have been chartered out. There are critics of that system. There are people who think that the schools should have been vouchered. There are people who think that all of that is a diminution of the public responsibility to provide free education without the interference of private groups. I'm not going to get into that fight. Suffice it to say, there has been a dramatic change in the way the school system is administered. So far, the test results don't show a huge improvement in student performance. But, of course, it's too early for these kinds of reforms or changes to have really shown their stuff.
I want to thank the caller. We're a bit past our midpoint here, and I have someone and I need to get to. Very quickly, I want to sneak in also a little bit of weather information for us here in our part of the state. There is the possibility of some severe thunderstorms this afternoon, and in fact, the Storms Prediction Center has issued a severe thunderstorm watch that will be in effect until 6 o'clock Central Time, and this does include a number of counties in Central and Southwestern Illinois. Ours included in our severe weather coverage area: Christian, Logan, Moultrie, Macon, McLean, Champaign, DeWitt, Piatt, Sangamon, and Shelby all included. And do stay tuned here to AM 580 throughout the day. We'll have more for the weather, more about the weather for you, and certainly our next comprehensive look at the weather comes at 12:35 on the Afternoon Magazine following our report of local and regional news. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Jed Horn. He's Metro Editor of the Times-Picayune newspaper. He was awarded a Pulitzer Prize for his part in the paper's coverage of Hurricane Katrina and is author of the book Breach of Faith, Hurricane Katrina and the Near Death of a Great American City, published by Random House. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. We have another caller here, or a caller here in Champaign, line 2. Hello.
Hello. This is so exciting to talk to you. My folks have been down there twice now to work with Habitat for Humanity and in Musician's Village. And I went down with my husband in October and visited the city. We had a wonderful time. Very emotional also. We drove.
We thank you for that, by the way. That's a wonderful addition to our recovery effort.
Well, you know, it doesn't feel like much. We drove down near the Industrial Canal and visited some of the devastated areas, drove clear down to Chalmette, went along Judge Perez Drive, actually saw a shuttered Super Walmart. You know, that's quite the thing. There aren't very many franchises down there. I think I counted one McDonald's and maybe one Popeyes.
In Chalmette, yeah.
Yeah, there's not much. It's very haunting. And I'm actually looking at a book right now called The Times-Picayune Katrina, The Ruin and Recovery of New Orleans, that was written by the staff of your newspaper. And it's quite a fascinating book. Shows maps of where the devastation was at its worst and beautiful pictures. I have a question that's not, and it's a subject that's not clear to me. There are many oil refineries down around New Orleans. My understanding is that a lot of the revenue from those refineries does not flow into New Orleans, but flows into different places in the country. Is that true?
Well, it's absolutely true. Some of it is recovered by the state of Louisiana, but there actually are no. Well, there may be one oil refinery on the West Bank, but the big infrastructure of refineries is farther up the river, out of Orleans Parish. And even though, you know, they're there because of New Orleans, and New Orleans is the sort of economic engine in this part of the world, the city is not able to put any direct tax on those refineries. We perhaps collect sales tax, given that people who make salaries off those refineries spend their money within Orleans Parish. But it goes elsewhere. And this is a very important insight of yours. People don't realize, people think of New Orleans as this kind of crybaby where we're forever got our hand out. We've been whacked by these storms, we need all this assistance. The reality is that Louisiana produces something like a fifth to a third of the nation's gasoline and natural gas, and the price of that infrastructure has been, in part, degradation of the coast by the oil industry over the years, and that degradation contributes in a very direct way to the destruction of New Orleans in the face of a hurricane. The hurricane sweep across the increasingly watery marshes between New Orleans and the sea, and they you know, storms in the old days were slowed down by those marshes, which we've lost to the tune of some 2,000 square miles of coastline in the last century or so. And that's why people need to understand that Louisiana is a national resource of that sort. Without those refineries, the price of gas would be $5 in Champaign Urbana right now. And no other state is willing to have those kinds of refineries built. You get a huge NIMBY reaction every time another state proposes to build a refinery. And the nation needs to understand that. The nation also needs to understand that the wetlands, which we, you know, group along with our levees as part of the coastal defense that must be maintained and nourished, are the largest fishery in the United States, hugely important both to what we put on our tables and to the vitality and health of the waters offshore. And, you know, these are the kind of peripheral aspects of storm defense and of the ecology of Louisiana that too many people forget about. For that reason, I'm glad you brought those topics up.
Well, it's a wonderful place, and I highly recommend anyone that can get down there, go down and spend some time. We were not troubled by crime or any of these things that, you know, seem to be the big subjects now, at least up here in the north. We just had a wonderful time. It's very emotional, too. You need to see what our country will let happen to a major American city.
Well, I certainly agree with you. As regards to crime, there has been, you know, there's crime has been an issue in a city. Any city that's been as traumatized and disrupted as New Orleans is going to have a certain amount of crime. It's not nearly as troubling as it had been, say, in the early 90s when so many cities, Atlanta, you know, Detroit, New Orleans, were in the teeth of really appalling homicide epidemics. The crime, for better or for worse, occurs among drug dealers almost exclusively and is easy to avoid. If you insist on buying drugs, don't buy them in New Orleans. You're likely to get yourself shot. But I think most of us can pass through a city of like New Orleans without buying or dealing drugs, and that is a pretty surefire preventive for any kind of crime or violence.
I want to thank the last caller. I have a couple of others here. Let me ask you a quick money question. Can you say in round figures how much money has been spent on recovery and rebuilding so far and where that money has come from? And particularly, I guess I'm interested in what the breakdown is, how much of this was state money came from within the borders of Louisiana and how much of it was federal money.
These are very fungible figures, and I'm afraid I'm not going to give you a very satisfactory answer. I mean, the Bush people will tell you, as they have loudly, that, you know, $100 billion was thrown into New Orleans, and maybe that's a meaningful figure. Within the administration, though, there was a lot of debate. Well, was it really 100? Was it 80? Was it 60? Don Powell, the liaison from the Bush administration to the Gulf Coast recovery area, had different figures than the White House. And then the further question is, okay, a lot of that money, it turns out, was just the regular operations budget of the huge federal bureaucracies, FEMA, the Army Corps, and so forth, that operate nationally, you know, with or without regard to New Orleans. So it's a difficult thing to say. A number that has been used is $100 million. Most of it would be federal money. Some of it yet to be seen. A lot of it tied up in all kinds of bureaucratic snafus that have kept it from reaching the streets. New Orleans and Louisiana are looking for about $7 to $10 billion in direct assistance to people who lost their homes in the storm. Money was allocated about $7.5 billion. It turns out to be a good few billion shy of what the actual losses are going to be. And then there's a further complication for reasons that are best understood by Michael Brown and others who seem to think they know how to run the world. For every dollar, for every $1 billion that the federal government gives to New Orleans, $100 million of it is meant to be sent back to Washington as the local share of this grant. I mean, you tell me why that makes sense, and I will be a wiser man, but it has caused enormous complications as the city tries to figure out how to get its billion-dollar share of a $10 billion allocation in order to give it back to Washington, which evidently has some claim on those same dollars. It's a crazy mess of red tape down here. Hmm. It's driven people crazy, and we nonetheless struggle along day by day trying to put our houses back together and put our schools back together and our courthouses and our hospitals and our water systems and our utilities and all the rest that went down during Katrina.
Well, let's talk with some of the folks who are listening next. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Yeah.
Good. I'm a former resident and actually a former pastor in New Orleans, and now I'm a student here at the university. I'd like for you to speak to the issue of Reconstruction on a couple levels. The first one would be, how would you characterize the progress of Reconstruction in the East? And the second one would be in terms of the competence and integrity, actually, of the contractors who are there. It seems like everyone with a hammer calls himself a contractor. And my house in particular, I was very disappointed with the results in terms of the price. And I'm wondering, you know, what is being done at this current point to make sure that the standards and the things that are necessary in terms of contractors, is that being something that's being identified as necessary? But again, the first question deals with the characterizing of the progress of the Reconstruction in the East.
The East is, you know, is very vulnerable and knows it, because it is east of the Industrial Canal and it is closer for that reason to the Gulf. And so it kind of got it both ways. It got the Gulf tide, it got the Gulf surge in from, well, every which way, including the intracoastal waterway, and then it also had the water that spilled out of the Industrial Canal when it collapsed. So you know as well as I do that the East was hard hit. I'm impressed and pleased by the vigor that's being shown out that way. Two or three different sectors come to mind. One is that you have, for example, in the Eastover area, which is an enclave, a gated community of rather rich folk, an absolute refusal to accept, you know, the sort of eradication of that community. It's a largely African-American community. It's a community of means and substance, and they have been tough. They have stood up to the city. They have stood up to planners who, you know, talked of writing off the East, and that's been interesting. You have also, farther to the east, the Vietnamese community, which has been just as resilient and just as tough. They have come back in strength. As one of them said to me when there was talk early on in the process of post-Katrina recovery of abandoning their neighborhood, you can't kick us off this land. We have buried our dead here. I mean, these are people who were, you know, boat people coming out of Vietnam, and they are not about to let a stretch of bad weather throw them off course. Another source of surprise has been the vigor, and it's a private sector investment, because evidently, I'm told, without even waiting on full, you know, to take full advantage of the tax incentives that are part of the recovery process through the so-called GO Zone programs, the Gulf Opportunity Zone Act, to rebuild those apartment complexes along the interstate that you and I know what we're talking about here. Others who haven't been to the city may not be as familiar with them, but devastated and critically important to the recovery of working-class housing for the city of New Orleans, low-income housing, so that we can get a workforce back here sufficient to do the jobs that are, you know, so urgently in need of execution. The East is coming back. It's one of 17. The Lake Plaza, Lake Forest Plaza area is targeted by our new recovery czar, Ed Blakely, as an area for special investment. In fact, it's getting the largest investment of any one of the 17 targeted zones. They've torn down that plaza. They're rebuilding it as a new and improved shopping area. And I think much will flow from that.
And then the second question I have with regard to the contractors. And
I've had some of the same experience that you are alluding to, and I think most of us are on guard and have to be on guard against fraud, against inferior workmanship, against outright rip-offs. You know, you hear these heartbreaking stories of, you know, the elderly person on a pension who, you know, gives over half of his or her insurance settlement to some contractor who simply disappears. This is being policed, but of course inadequately. The job is simply so enormous that the opportunities for fraud remain equally enormous. At the same time, I think, you know, the majority of us see the work completed. The costs are high, as you discovered. There's a huge demand for labor. The cost of supplies has shot up. I had to put some copper trim on my roof, which had shingling blown off of it. And, you know, I wound up spending, you know, $5,000 on trim that I think 18 months earlier would have cost me about half as much. It's tough,
yeah.
But for that reason, the insurance settlements are badly needed, and the road home money, which is
that was going to be my next question.
All right,
might squeeze that one in. Where are we with that?
Well, the road home, of course, has been a catastrophic disappointment to certainly to Governor Blanco, who kind of pinned her hopes for re-election on it. It turns out to be fraught with problems. Very simply, this unprecedentedly large effort to put money in the hands of people who had lost their homes, federal money, which had been provided to the state in the form of, you know, community development block grants, took a very long time to start reaching people's pockets, and as a result, took a very long time to start showing itself in the form of rebuilt houses. Public frustration was huge and fully justified. The decision was made to stay with the contractor who is distributing that money, the ICF International Company, for the simple reason that changing horses in midstream would have delayed the process even worse, much as we may be disappointed in ICF. I think right now we're starting to see the grant money at long last, you know, flow out into the community, and a process that we thought was going to be largely completed as much as a year ago is finally gathering steam. There's been a shortfall in terms of the money. That can be rectified with an additional allocation from Congress, probably to the tune of another billion or so. But that's small change in the scheme of things, given the $100 billion overall cost of this disaster resulting from the failure of the federal levy system.
We're very short on time. I want to try to get at least one more caller. We'll go to Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. my brother works in New Orleans and lives there. And he also works for the state of Louisiana and stayed behind to work in the Superdome when the hurricane hit. So I was very interested in getting any news that I could possibly get. You know, I stayed up late listening to the radio or you know, on the Internet. And I just wanted to say thank you and your newspaper for the excellent coverage that you did during that time. I mean, I was just astounded.
Thank you.
Appreciated it. I know that... you know, you had some trouble getting a paper out, and I think you went from paper to virtual reporting.
For 3 days we were not able to print.
Could you, I have a journalism background, and I was just wondering if you can spend maybe a minute or so discussing of how you went about putting out that newspaper during that time, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for your nice words. We retreated to Baton Rouge as an office. Our offices were flooded in New Orleans, or at least the grounds were flooded. The press, fortunately, was not, or we would probably not be in business today. We went online for 3 days. We printed then on borrowed presses, first in the home of Thibodeau area and then in Mobile, Alabama, where we have a sister paper. The challenge then was distributing it. We could print the copies, and we knew how eager people were to read the paper. There was a huge affection and respect for what we did. I'm very pleased to say we came through when we needed to. The trick was to put the paper in people's hands. Many of us within the circulation area and across the country found our way to www.nola.com, which is our website. And there was a giant increase in our readership through the electronic means of the Internet, and we continue to enjoy that that improvement in our internet presence. The circulation of the paper is off by about a third on the printed product, but the interest remains keen, and for that reason, the paper is financially a go. We're modestly profitable again, and are very, very pleased by the support that the community has shown for the Times-Picayune.
Just very, very quickly, why is there still no comprehensive redevelopment plan for the city?
Well, there is one, actually. The so-called UNOP plan was completed and was passed on to the state and to the federal government as was required, a condition for getting federal dollars. But it is entirely comprehensive, and for that reason, the recovery, the forces of recovery will have to pick and choose from the menu of things that are out there. The latest iteration of it is this plan by the recovery czar, Ed Blakely, for 17 nodes into which resources will be poured all across the city, the hope being that they will spark revival in those 17 respective areas that will then spread and eventually knit the city back together again. There is a plan, but it is the challenge is enormous down here. It's exciting. But it can be overwhelming at times, and we live kind of from day to day, thrilling to the moment as well as appalled by how much work there is ahead.
Well, thanks very much for giving us some of your time. We certainly appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate David being on. Thank you.
Our guest Jed Horn is Metro Editor of the Times-Picayune newspaper, awarded a Pulitzer Prize for his part in the paper's coverage of Hurricane Katrina. If you want to read news of New Orleans, you can read the paper online, as he said, at NOLA.com. Also, if you'd like to read about Hurricane Katrina, you can look for his book, Breach of Faith, Hurricane Katrina and the Near Death of a Great American City. The book was published by Random House, and it came out last July. Programs here on AM 580 WILL-AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. The 2007-2008 season brochure and KrannertCenter.com announcements of the 2007-2008 season of guest artists will be available by the end of June. That is it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned because there's much more. News, features, weather, other things coming up as part of the afternoon magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. We will talk with a journalist in the 1 o'clock hour of the afternoon magazine. His name is Russ Parsons, and he's the food and wine columnist for the Los Angeles Times. He's been writing about food and agriculture for 20 years. He's also the author of the new book, How to Pick a Peach, The Search for Flavor from Farm to Table. We'll talk with him at 1:06 Central Time. Let's take a look now at commodity prices in Kansas City. July wheat trading at 487, up 6.5. September 497, up 5. In Chicago, July wheat 501.5, up 5. September 513, up 3.5. December 520.5, up 3.75. July corn 369.75, up 6.5. September 375, up 6.5. December corn 377.25, up 6.25. July soybeans 779, up 8.5. August 786, up 9.25. November 807.75, up 8.25. July meal 208.40, up 190. July oil 34.69, up 20. At the Mercantile Exchange in Chicago.